Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of the School of Business, Management, and Economics at the University of Sussex. This is a sidecast for episode 39, where we are discussing Michael Cohen, James March, and Johann P. Olson's 1972 article, A Garbage Can Model of Decision-Making, published in Administrative Science Quarterly. To get the text and for more information, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. My name is Tom Galvin, and I'm recording from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States. And this sidecast is on the value of exploratory models for studying complex behaviors, spurred by this particular episode. What brought on the desire to do this sidecast was that I had my attention drawn to the program that was written and presented in an appendix in the article, completely written in Fortran 66. And so while everybody else was drawn on the more traditional aspects of organizational behavior and decision-making that the model was representing, I was drawn much more to the technical details of the model and to the Fortran code. And why this is the case, perhaps I should explain with a little bit of my own background. Organization studies was not my first field of study or practice. My academic career began in the fields of computer science and artificial intelligence. This was the field that I earned my first master's degree back in 1994 from the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. And back then, many of the applications we now take for granted, such as Microsoft Office products, email, internet browsers, and so on, did not yet exist or were very rudimentary. And so, as with many of my peers, I spent a lot of time basically writing my own programs, doing all my own coding, especially when it came to doing models and simulations, because modeling tools at the time were extremely limited. And so what I reflected on as I went through and studied the model and studied the article was a long ago forgotten project of a similar exploratory vein that I was involved with back in the mid-1990s when I was assigned at the U.S. Army War College here in Carlisle as a Army captain. At that time, in the mid-1990s, the U.S. military's war colleges came to recognize that in the post-Cold War environment, military leaders needed to be strategic thinkers capable of understanding an increasingly complex global environment. Soviet communism was no longer the driving threat, and the United States found itself involved in a number of smaller conflicts around the globe, such as Somalia, Bosnia, and others. And so a U.S. military, trained and ready to hold the line between West and East Europe, had to reorient itself to produce leaders with the skills and competencies needed for a different environment. And so a team of faculty from the Army War College and the Industrial College of the Armed Forces, or ICAF, located in Washington, D.C., were working together on a program to coach and mentor the military's future leaders in this new environment. Leading the effort was ICAF faculty member T. Owen Jacobs, who with Elliot Jakes had developed stratified systems theory. Stratified systems theory describes how as environmental complexity increases, a system's complexity must increase in kind. For organizations, stratified system theory's application has been in how hierarchical levels translate to vertical differentiation of complexity. Seven strata divided among three domains, called direct, organizational, and strategic, describe how holding positions of leadership at progressively higher levels translate to higher order responsibilities and time horizons. In fact, we are planning on covering stratified systems theory in a future episode of the podcast. The team employed stratified systems theory as a basis for measuring the preparedness of students in the two schools for assuming positions of higher leadership, and to set up an individual development program to help coach students through the transition. Using available personality and psychological instruments, which at the time were limited and expensive, they measured personality traits, cognitive abilities, and emotional intelligence. They analyzed the results and provided one-on-one feedback to the students. The students, in turn, would use this information to construct a personal development plan to carry them through the school year. The problem that the faculty faced was simple. There were only four or five ICAF faculty members with the requisite skills and knowledge, And what I'm referring to there is psychology, behavior science, and so on, that basically interpreting the results of the instrument and conducting good quality one-on-one feedback was very, very time-consuming. It took several hours per student, and the four or five faculty members had to cover an entire class of several hundred students. And so the demands for time were simply too great. The Army War College faced a similar problem, lots of students, not enough expertise to do the work. And so the two schools needed to provide a way for any faculty member to interpret the results of the instruments and deliver useful feedback. And so this is where I came in. I had joined the U.S. Army War College in 1995, serving in one of its non-teaching institutes as an artificial intelligence specialist doing various projects in support of the educational program there. At the time, the Army had a robust artificial intelligence program where junior officers like me would go to graduate school for artificial intelligence and then serve in a utilization tour at various Army schools and research institutes. And so when this faculty team came to my group to look for help, I was assigned to consult. I quickly assessed that they were looking for an expert system, which was a fairly common artificial intelligence application that often used qualitative methods. What is an expert system? Let me explain that real briefly without too much technical detail. They're computer programs that encode expertise in the form of information and rules. And the goal is that a non-expert could plug in the data and derive similar results as an expert would. So one builds an expert system by interviews, observations, and other means of just basically drawing out the expertise that's embedded within the expert's mind, and then encoding it and turning it into a program. This is a lot harder than it sounds because a lot of experts really do have difficulty explaining how do they make expert decisions. And so it becomes challenging to try to separate what do they consider important versus what do they consider unimportant? What rules did they use? What rules of thumb, heuristics did they use? And so that basically fell on me to separate what was clear, hard, and fast rules that were easy to decipher, separate them from the hunches and the guesswork to come up with a structure by which we could get the data fed in and converge on an answer that best approximates the judgment of the faculty that I was working with. Now, an application of the expert system is diagnostics, such as how does an expert interpret problems to identify some sort of root cause? A famous early expert system diagnosed headaches, taking the sometimes ambiguous and contradictory information of a patient and diagnosing which type among the many hundreds of different types of headaches have been identified in the literature. So basically, that was the kind of an expert system that the team was looking for. We would take the results of the battery of instruments that each student took, and we would essentially diagnose or draw out a set of key strengths, possible vulnerabilities, anything that could be useful for feedback in support of the student's ability to build their own development programs. I spent a couple of months of learning about the instruments that the faculty team were using and conducting both group and individual interviews. I collected a considerable amount of information about how the faculty went about their business. They generally went about their task a certain way, looking at one instrument first to develop a quick picture, then moving on to the other instruments to look for confirming information. One of the things that I would come to learn is that among military officers, some factors across the instruments tended to correlate. And so that allowed the faculty members to devise a lot of shortcuts, which I was able to develop as rules for the expert system. For example, two of the instruments in use at the time were the Myers-Briggs Type Indicator, or the MBTI, and the Kirtan Adaptation Innovation Inventory, or the KAI. Among the military population, two of the four scales in the MBTI were correlated that generally don't correlate with the general population. And these two scales also correlated with the main result of the KAI. The faculty were able to very quickly translate these correlations into a possible vulnerability. In this case, the correlation suggested a preference to render decisions quickly rather than seek additional information. Feedback to the student might therefore include improving one's ability to show empathy. So capturing these expected relationships among the data was simple enough, but there weren't very many that the faculty actually agreed upon, and therein lay the first challenge, finding agreement. And that was necessary if I was going to be able to come up with a single set of rules which would replicate the expert judgment. The second challenge was even more daunting. The faculty spent most of their time on the unexpected findings, those that seemed contradictory or unusual, or, as they put it, interesting. They would spend the majority of their time grappling with the unexpected, attempting to generate meaning from the results. Among the test cases that we used during various sessions that I conducted, a few cases would produce wildly opposite interpretations by the faculty. So what I wound up with in my data was a bunch of assertions and rules built on the exceptions, but not really a good easy sense of how the whole thing fit together. This pretty much prevented me from getting an expert system to deliver a unified result. It didn't help that the disagreements among the team members were getting more intense as we went along. And there were even discussions about what constituted a normal or a, you know, what constituted a strength versus what constituted a vulnerability. And so I had a challenge trying to get the project moving. So my approach was to build an expert system-like model that captured all the rules and assertions that I had, and I started tinkering with it. I programmed it using a system that I was able to get from the U.S. government. It was an expert system development. Just basically coded it myself, and then I tinkered with it to figure out what kind of cases, what were the potential range of cases that weren't explored yet? What were exceptions that had yet to be raised? And so what I essentially did was craft a model that behaved a lot like the garbage can model that was in the article. Here were a bunch of facts requiring interpretation over here. These were problems. Over there were a number of rules that did not apply perfectly, but perhaps could. Those were decisions. And then my attempts at figuring out how to reconcile the contradictions and such, those essentially were like the access matrices. So running the model a few times, I began developing possible rules for patterns that I believe that the faculty might find interesting or that might help with reconciling some of the differences. After a few iterations, I was able to feedback some ideas back to the faculty and ask them questions such as, if you found profiles that had this information, would you interpret it as blank? So by the time that we had a video teleconference sometime later, both my ideas and the team's own deliberations on the discussions, they'd resolved a lot of the differences in perspectives. Basically, the model served its purpose to help resolve some of the impasses. We did ultimately come to the conclusion, which I still believe is correct, that an expert system was not really appropriate for the task. There was still too much subjective judgment involved that just needed to remain. You just couldn't get rid of it. So an expert system was not able to provide a suitable or acceptable interpretation of the data, certainly compared to just simply teaching and coaching the other faculty members to be able to come up with similar judgments on their own. So my work on the exploratory model basically ended at that point, and ultimately it was lost in the bit bucket in the sky when I left U.S. Army War College in the summer of 1997. So as I thought about that experience and related it to the Cohen article from episode 39, I could draw a couple of conclusions. First, the earlier days of computing allowed a great number of scientists and technologists to do their own programming. Those that developed programming skills had the ability to craft small-scale, elegant models that helped them grasp complex or uncertain phenomena. When I look at the tools available to me during my doctoral program a few years ago, I was amazed at how sophisticated and powerful that they were, until I learned that they were so sophisticated and powerful that they did not provide much room for creativity. So sometimes I would instead turn to basic spreadsheet programs to do certain mathematical tasks my way, and I found it more satisfying than, say, using a quantitative statistical platform that we had available at George Washington University. The Fortran 66 program in Kohn's article looks indecipherable because Fortran 66 was a very rudimentary programming language. Now, I had never used Fortran before, but once I figured out using online resources, I realized fairly quickly how simple the model was. As you remarked in various parts of the episode, it was amazing what the authors were able to glean from the results of that model. For me, I might have considered some of their findings a bit fantastic and even questionable had I not taken the time to study the source code to see what they were actually doing. And so, in essence, the value of the model was the ability to share a thought process that might otherwise not be available, especially considering that the size or the length of the program was very, very short. A full computer program that you might write nowadays could take a book in order to be able to print it out. The second conclusion was that there should be more room for these kinds of articles in today's organizational literature. I do find it an unsettling pattern how many classic works of organization science that we have explored in the Talking About Organizations podcast are assessed as being unpublishable today. Cohen et al. Represents a very unusual case whereby full details of a non-empirical model are disclosed in a peer-reviewed journal. Similar approaches would seem useful as a first step for exploring complex longitudinal phenomena. I would not be surprised if there are some researchers out there who are doing just that. Now, as an addendum for this blog post, I took on an effort to translate the Fortran 66 program into a modern programming language to see if I could get it to work. The good news is that I was mostly successful. Available in this blog post is the Python 3.6 source code, which can be imported into a Python environment as written. Python is a popular beginner's programming language, which has a lot of the similar structural capabilities for learning programming as, say, C or Ada or some of the other languages that are used commercially. And it's also free, which is also helpful. I say it was mostly successful because some of the summary statistics just don't appear to be calculating correctly, so I'm not getting the same exact results that that were shown in the article. Part of this, I believe, is because Fortran and Python do things a little bit differently, and a direct line-by-line translation is not exactly possible. So if anybody has programming experience and wants to know more about the model and the challenges I face trying to make it work, or if you have any other feedback on this blog post or anything else about the podcast, you can certainly contact me at Tom P. Galvin, TomPGalvin, at gwmail@gwu.edu. And that concludes this sidecast. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed this discussion and found it valuable. Please give us feedback, which we love to receive, via Twitter, Facebook, or through our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Also, please tell your friends, colleagues, and students who may be interested in talking about organizations.